And we will go on to the second case of the day, which is 072984, Domka versus Portage County.
May it please the court, I'm Jeff Olson. I'm here representing James Domka, the plaintiff appellant. We appealed after Judge Shabazz granted summary judgment dismissing our claims. Our theory was that Mr. Domka was deprived of liberty or property or both when both his home detention and Huber work release privileges were summarily revoked. Relying on this court's decision in Page versus Hudson, the district court said that Mr. Domka may have had a liberty interest in remaining on home detention, but held that he had waived that interest or waived any right to due process when he signed the pre-printed forms that the Sheriff's Department had him sign as a condition of participating in the home detention program. I've been wanting to say these words to this court since the day Mr. Domka walked into my office. If you tell state and local governments that they can induce effective waivers of fundamental constitutional rights by making people sign pre-printed forms as a condition of participation in a program or receiving a benefit or service, they will all do it all the time.
Why is that? Because they don't have a choice or because they want to stay home?
I'm telling you the governments will put waivers into all their forms and they will make everybody waive their rights because it will protect them from their violations of the Constitution.
But in exchange for what?
Getting your garbage picked up or being in the home detention program or whatever.
As far as this is concerned, because this is, of course, the key issue here, is if they... he would have had a shorter prison term had he just gone to prison, stayed there, and then he's out.
That's correct.
He made a choice. He said, I'd rather be at home most of the time, or I guess that's what it was supposed to be, and in exchange for these, I don't know what you want to call them, waivers or reservations, or frankly, it's pretty binding. And that's the question, and I guess you're saying that there's coercive in the wasn't really a choice or something.
Well, it was a two-stage process. The waivers that the county relies on weren't presented to him when he made his choice to take a longer sentence with home detention rather than a shorter sentence in the jail. They were presented to him only after he'd already made that choice, several days later after he'd served most of the jail period of his longer sentence and was getting ready for the at-home period. He went in to sign up for the home detention program, and only then was he presented with these waiver forms as a fait accompli.
Well, if he had not wanted to sign the waiver form, then he still had a choice, right?
He
could have gone back. If he had withdrawn and said, I don't want to sign this waiver form. I don't want to have this home detention. I'd rather go back and finish my sentence. You're saying he couldn't do that?
He could have stayed in jail, but he would have had to serve the longer sentence.
Correct.
He'd already bargained away his shorter sentence for the right to serve home detention, and there was no getting that shorter sentence back if he didn't want to sign the waiver forms.
But you see, my problem is that the language couldn't have been clearer about what would happen if the sobrietor tested positive for any reason. And it even unambiguously warned him about certain foods that could trigger a positive reading. It stated that he could be immediately removed from HPT and Huber without notice or appeal following a positive reading. And so just as Judge Williams noted, at that time he had a choice, and he admits that he understood everything that he was signing. Of course, he claims his understanding, you know, was informed by Officer Borski's oral statements, but with the abundantly clear language of the agreement, you know, any argument about an oral modification isn't compelling.
Let's not talk about an oral modification then. We'll stand on our position on that in the briefs, and we'll talk about whether the government can ever present forms like this that effect a waiver of due process rights. The case law that we've cited in our brief suggests that you have to look at two factors. One is, was the waiver knowing, intelligent, and voluntary? The fact that it's a pre-printed contract of adhesion is one factor to look at. The fact that he didn't have the benefit of counsel when he was presented with these forms is another factor to look at. The second factor that this court...
Did anyone keep him from having counsel there?
Did anybody keep him from having counsel, and did he ask for counsel? I'd add that to the question.
Yeah.
The record doesn't answer those questions, either one of them, one way or the other. He was presented the forms, though, and told to sign them at the time.
I mean, you know, of course, people sign away appeal rights every day of the week. I'm always, you know, shocked by that. But it's the law, I mean, to sign away appeal rights. How is this any different?
It is, because people don't sign away their appeal rights as part of a non-negotiable second stage of the negotiations. They sign away their appeal rights as part of a package deal. If we had these forms in court when Mr. Domka had counsel and was deciding whether to take the longer sentence at home or the shorter sentence in jail, and the judge was telling him, if you take the shorter sentence in jail, you're waiving all of your due process, or if you take the longer sentence at home, you're waiving all of your due process rights, and you'll have to sign these forms. And even if the machine is wrong, you've got no chance of reversal. Then we would have a different case. But he didn't have the forms in front of him or that sort of notice at the time he negotiated his arrangement. All he could do by the time he got the forms was give up the right that he'd already bargained for, the right to go home.
What was in exchange for that bargain before he had the waivers? Why would he be able to stay home as opposed to stay in prison? What you say he'd already bargained for it.
He had already bargained for it in his plea agreement when he pled guilty to drunk driving. He had a choice between a 4-month sentence, most of it at home, or a 3-month sentence, all in jail.
So that was the bargain.
That was the choice, and he chose to give up that shorter sentence in order to get
he gave up the shorter sentence in order to stay home for confinement, whatever you call it, for a longer period of time.
Right. And he didn't know at that time that he was going to be asked to sign these waiver forms.
So they added these provisions, and you're basically saying by adding those provisions, he was what, coerced without counsel or something like that?
It kept it from being a knowing, intelligent, bargained for waiver of his rights.
That would only be available if it were with counsel and, I guess, in front of a judge.
Well, every factor weighs. I'm not saying anyone is the make or break factor, but if it had been there at the time he made the choice, we'd have a different case. Also, I think we argued in our brief that when you're evaluating the validity of a waiver of fundamental constitutional rights, you have to look under Tennessee Secondary School Association at whether the waiver was necessary to managing an efficient and effective program. That's the words the Supreme Court used. Or whether it was, quote, reasonable. That's the word this court used in Burgess versus Lowry. The county hasn't even argued in its brief that the waiver here was either necessary to managing its program or reasonable.
You would know how many were on this program or how many of these, what do you call them, the thing that's just the detector, whatever it's called, is are there a lot of them out there, or is this very unique, or do you know?
I don't think the record reflects it. We did some discovery, and we got a handful of things back showing people who'd been revoked off the program, I think. But it isn't clear how many people are on the program. But,
and so you're saying it's unreasonable for the county to have such a program that is utilized with people who get convicted of drunk driving violations?
I'm saying
this kind of testing program and organize this program.
I'm saying it's unreasonable to have a person waive all due process rights in connection with this program, including the right to have a second test done perhaps at their own expense. You know, they told him.
Well, didn't he have another test done within 5 minutes?
Oh, it was the same machine. It wasn't another test. It was just the same machine that conducted the same test a second time. And then it conducted the same test a little bit later, and he tested clear for alcohol. What he'd been promised was a deputy to come test him, have the deputy test him with a different piece of equipment, and then if he was positive, take him to the hospital for a blood test. Even that elaborate level of process wouldn't have been necessary because they could have said, you tested positive for alcohol, you can go and get a blood test at your own expense. That's your due process. They didn't even do that. I'm going to save my time for a rebuttal if you don't mind.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, Mr. Olson. My name is Mike Modell, M-O-D-L. I represent Portage County. This is a civil rights action, a Section 1983 claim, where Mr. Domka claims that he was entitled to some procedural due process before he could be revoked on the home detention program for Portage County. This was after he tested twice positive for alcohol on the sobrietor.
Let me just ask you a question just generally. Is there any recourse for a person who registers a false positive on the sobrietor?
Is there
any recourse? Is there any way they can rebut it or argue with it, or, you know, is there any kind of recourse, any kind of process, any kind of, you know, can they go get a blood test and bring the blood test back? I'm just curious.
Well, there is a second test that if it only gets used within 5 minutes after somebody tests positive.
The same machine.
Yeah. Portage County is a relatively small county. It has about 65,000-67,000 people. It doesn't monitor 24/7 the results, so it can be 24 hours, as it was in this case, basically between the time somebody registers a positive and the time somebody sees that they registered a positive.
So the bottom line is there's no recourse. You get your first test, you get tested within 5 minutes with the same machine, and if it's positive, that's just it. Doesn't matter if there's a malfunction in the machine.
That would be correct. The machines are tested and recalibrated on a regular basis, but it's correct that if somebody tests positive once, they test positive a second time under the procedure the sobrietor uses, that that person doesn't get a third test.
And has there ever been an instance where the county had trouble with the sobrietors registering false positives?
No. And the evidence in this case is this particular sobrietor, we provided those records during discovery, and there were no problems but in the relevant time period between the last calibration, the use of it for Mr. Domka and others, and then the next recalibration. There
right.
were no false positives.
Yeah, I understood as it related to the facts here, there were no false positives. I just wondered generally whether there had been any time when there were false positives registering with these machines.
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor.
What do you make of the fact that Portage County typically requested a court order to revoke an individual's Huber privileges for 60 days when it terminated his HDP participation, but that there wasn't an order like that sought in this case?
Well, what Portage County does, Your Honor, is if the person is going to be off of Huber for more than 60 days, they will then seek a court order. In this case, Mr. Domke had, I believe, 41 days left on his sentence that he served in jail, so they did not go to court and ask for that court order.
What's the remedy in this case? Or what's, you know, he's out of prison, it's over. What's what happens with the result of this case?
I'm not sure I understand.
But what's the next step? Do we say you can't do this anymore, or is there damages? Are there what are we looking at here?
Well, the relief that the plaintiff is seeking is damages in the case, emotional distress damages, and a claim for lost wages.
Because he lost his job?
Correct. The trial court granted summary judgment on the basis of waiver, and I think the court is exactly correct that the language of the documents that were provided to Mr. Domke are unequivocal. They are clear, unambiguous as to what they say and what the waiver is. Wisconsin statute sets up the home detention program and provides that in order to have such a program, each county has to set up and establish regulations and written documentation with terms and conditions. The county did that, and those terms and conditions are really two documents that are before the court.
First, does it vary from county to county?
Sir?
Does this vary from county to county?
It does. Portage County has the two documents are, one is the Portage County Home Detention Criteria, which also has the sobriety information, which applied to Mr. Domke. And then Portage County also had the Portage County Sheriff's Department Home Detention Program, which was the document that has 20-some areas that Mr. Domke went through with the correctional officer and initialed. The language on the sobriety client information clearly says any alcohol reading on a sobriety will result in immediate removal from HDP, home detention program, and you will lose HDP and Huber privileges. That document was provided to Mr. Domke when he went over it with the individual correctional officer and signed it, indicating that he understood and agreed to comply with it. The Portage County Sheriff's Department Home Detention Program contains three relevant provisions. They're paragraphs 8, 16, and 12. The court has those in the brief, but 12 is the provision that specifically states, I understand that a violation of any of these conditions of the agreement will cause my removal from the program without notice or avenue of appeal. The record is clear that Mr. Domke, based on his deposition testimony, that he met with Officer Borski on the 27th of June, the date that he started the program. He went over each and every one of the paragraphs in these documents prior to initialing. Each of these 20-plus items, Mr. Domke was provided the opportunity to ask questions, and he did ask questions. Those questions were always answered. There was no refusal to answer questions. Specifically on the waiver issue, he went over the paragraph that dealt with no appeal rights, no notice rights, had a chance to ask questions about that. There is no evidence in the record that he ever asked for any attorney. He did have a criminal attorney in the underlying OWI action. Again, no request for any counsel. He was provided a copy of the written document, so he had that with him at all times. He spoke with his counselor in the AODA program, who also informed him, she was familiar with this program, that, in fact, any violation would result in termination from both programs, HDP and the Huber program. The language could not have been more specific. The language could not have been more unambiguous. This is not a situation where any language was hidden. The waiver language is front and center when it was went over with Mr. Domke. specifically. It's not fine print, this suggestion of contracts of adhesion. There's no reason to view this as any kind of a contract of adhesion. Mr. Domko is not singled out in any way. Everyone who's on the program in Portage County gets the same documentation. They go through the same process and are required to sign off on this program and on these sheets. I appreciate the court probably understands the sobriety or how that works, but since there's some difference in the record on that, if I could just take 30 seconds. The sobriety is hooked up to a telephone at the individual's house, and how it works is there's a tone that comes across, which means it's time to get tested. After that first tone, there's a three-minute wait period, and that 3 minutes is in case the person's eating, they can finish chewing, they can rinse out their mouth. After that 3 minutes, there's another tone saying it's now time for the test. They talk into the directions given by the sobrieter. It says, say this word, Orlando. And the person says they hold this device up to their face, and they say the three or four words with the commands by the sobrieter. So Orlando was one of the terms, for example. Once the sobrieter is up against the face, it cannot be removed. So somebody cannot say the three words for voice recognition, give it to somebody else who then does the next part of the test, which is the blow into the test. Mr. Domka had some problems, and it's not uncommon, with the device. You see from the records that there are a number of failures which relate to too much background noise, relate to not blowing hard enough, not blowing long enough, not talking loudly enough. Those are all problems that are not unusual. But again, the sobrieter walks somebody through how you ask them to repeat, and so that, in fact, they end up with a clear test.
Well, in those cases, there would be no result, I presume. It didn't work to that extent, so they have to do it again.
Correct, but there is a result because it asks the person to do it again, to talk louder, to...
Didn't register whatever happened.
Yeah, and that's what he was complaining about. He said that there were all these instances when he got failures over a certain period, but none of them were attributable to alcohol.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The court's aware that people waive constitutional rights all the time. We waive. Mr. Domka pled guilty to the underlying offense of OWI 3rd. He waived a whole slew of constitutional rights. He waives his rights to jury trial. People do that all the time. This is not a difficult situation that is outside any norm. And in this case, it is absolutely clear that Mr. Domko was informed of exactly what it was that he was giving up, and he made the choice. His choice was, I want to be at home. I want to live with my girlfriend rather than living in a jail cell. And for that, I'm willing to make the choice of doing certain things, including, in signing the form, giving up any rights I would have to notice, giving up any right I would otherwise have to an appeal. But we believe that Judge Shabazz got it correct in finding that there had been a waiver by Mr. Domka of any process that he otherwise would be due. The second issue in the case is whether or not Mr. Domka even had a liberty interest in where he would get process before he could be removed from the home detention program. Liberty interests are created by state law, typically, and we know that Mr. Domka has taken a position that the state statute didn't create any such rights. And the court looking at the statute would come to the same conclusion. Our state statute in Wisconsin is very permissive, and for that reason, in responding to summary judgment, Mr. Domka said, I am not making a claim for a liberty interest based upon there being state right, a right flowing out of the state statute. Mr. Domka talked about a plea agreement giving rise to a liberty interest, and the district court found that to not be the case, and I agree that certainly would not be the case. The plea agreement was that he would have the opportunity to participate in this program. He did. He had to participate subject to the same rules that anyone else participates subject to. He violates the rules. That doesn't change the fact that the plea agreement was complied with. Mr. Domka looks to the due process clause for the basis of his liberty interest. And the due process clause, in the county's brief, I've briefed to the court that the due process clause recognizes some fundamental rights, and I didn't provide that for purposes of suggesting in any way this was a substantive due process case. It's a procedural due process case, but that's one of the sources of liberty interests. The liberty interest that Mr. Domka is looking for here is not based on any of those fundamental rights. It's based on a variety of court cases that with prisoners where the courts have not been completely consistent. There's the Sandlin case from the U.S. Supreme Court that essentially says for prisoners there are very few liberty interests they're going to have short of loss of good time credits. But there is some suggestion that that applies only to state-created liberty interests versus other type of liberty interests, and courts have been inconsistent on that. There's the Meacham case out of the U.S. Supreme Court that says there is no right of an individual to be at a certain facility, and that's been applied in circumstances where people are in halfway houses, not just in different prisons. And then there's the Young and the Page decision, Page out of this court, where there can be a certain level of freedom. I'm at my end. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Olson, how much time?
4 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
We did argue below and here that a portion of Mr. Domka's protected liberty and property interests come from state statute, especially in connection with the Huber program, where the statutes require a court hearing if there's going to be a suspension of privileges more than 5 days. With respect to whether there is a liberty interest, the authorities, I think, suggest that this court look at three factors. One, did the liberty that was taken away include the right to live at home? If it did, Page versus Hudson says the 14th Amendment applies. Number two, was the liberty that was taken away conferred by the sentencing court? If it was, then Sandin and Hewitt versus Helms and this court's decision in Whitford versus Boglino say the 14th Amendment applies. Number three, did state law create a, quote, legitimate claim of entitlement in the liberty at issue? If it did, Shango versus Jurich, this court's decision, says the 14th Amendment applies. I'd like to talk to you for a second about a case that was decided by Judge Shabazz, and it's cited in the briefs. It's available on Westlaw, Tanisha Wells versus Dane County. In that case, Tanisha Wells was in the Dane County Home Detention Program. She tested positive for drugs on a urine test. She was taken into jail immediately, and the court held she had effectively waived her right to pre-detention process. But she got post-deprivation process, and she got a second test, and it proved that there had been the one and only false positive in the history of that machine, and she got to go back home. You don't know how many false positives you're going to have from a machine until you start letting people have a second different test. That's what that Wells case teaches us. And that's the Wells case illustrates the way things ought to work here. The machine already talks to the participants and says things like, talk slower, blow harder. It could say, you, my friend, have just tested positive for alcohol. You have 90 minutes to secure a blood alcohol test at your own expense and report in person to the sheriff's department. It could be that simple, and that might be all the process that's due in this case. But under the authorities that we've cited, and this is a contract of adhesion, that's just what a pre-printed form that's presented to somebody with no bargaining power that everybody that gets in the program have to sign is, a complete waiver is unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you, and the case will be taken under advisement. We'll go on to John.